In a series of essays written for the journal Historically Speaking, Southwest Minnesota State University Professor Emeritus of History and Dean of Local and Regional History, Joseph Amato explores the changing landscape, people, politics, and economics of the rural Midwest, and what that all means for our understanding of local history. Amato is something of an evangelist for the practice of local history. His couple dozen books include Rethinking Home, A Case for Writing Local History, Jacob's Well, A Case for Rethinking Family History, and When Father and Son Conspire, A Minnesota Farm Murder. That's about the killing of two bankers in Lincoln County, Minnesota, just across the South Dakota border 30 years ago this fall. Professor Amato's most recent book is Surfaces History, and he joined us last spring to talk about that. Well, he's back here in our studios at the University of Sioux Falls to talk about these new essays. Welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Thank you, Carl.
Yeah, I got to put your mic up there. There we go.
Not loud enough.
Yeah, they were good. I didn't have that up. I guess the first question is pretty basic. Why is local history important and valuable?
Well, to make one simple answer, it's place, and that's where we first get our body, our skin, and our sensation. So local history is the collection, I mean, it's an infinite collection of places where we have those primary or elemental experiences.
In reading the essays, one of the things that you remark on in the first one is that most local history is done by amateurs, and I'm wondering how that approach affects our understanding and knowledge of local history.
That's a wonderful question, and I could get in trouble different ways. One type of amateur history comes with true enthusiasm to capture, in a certain way, to validate, legitimize, or keep alive the worlds of the dead. Mm-hmm. And it has a commemorative, can have a nostalgic core, and that type of local history is invaluable to all historians because their tendency is to preserve and record. Sometimes the downside is they can collect too much and they can turn history into the museum that's too large to heat. You just can't afford to keep all that stuff. And there is a danger for the amateur historian not knowing when they lose sight of the details they wish to gather and they, you might say, cavort with general theories or national theories, then they can become repetitious and redundant. So they all tell us the 1930s were dirty, or if you go into a certain aspect of place, you can find a bootlegger. And in that way, if you've been to one local museum or read one of their local works, with a little imagination, not much stretch, you've read them all, because rather than capturing the local as specific, they're capturing the local as generically understood. And that's you could have a lot of arguments where that line is, but that's an important distinction.
I mean, you bring up nostalgia. I'm wondering what the line is there with nostalgia and history. How do you separate that? Take a step back? Is that how you get rid of nostalgia? Or maybe nostalgia is part of history, and that's an integral part of it.
I actually think nostalgia is good. I'd even try this daring, and it's kind of a daring thought, that nostalgia in your heart is more important than a belief in progress. but that might appeal to older people more than it does to younger people.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, remembering, the function of remembering with emotion, let's call that nostalgia, remembering with focused emotion, may be more valuable for an activity of our mind, our soul, our spirit, than joining notions of how we're going to make a better future or make things more efficient or have to take fewer steps from the parking lot to where we're going. And in that way, that side of our mind continually keeps us rich in paths when our feet have begun to travel on rather common and cemented roads. So it forms an alternative to the centralizing and generalizing forces. Now, I realize I'm talking quite abstractly, but that's one of the things that I either bring to local history and should or don't. But I really do think that nostalgia is invigorating and enriching the soul, but it can slip into soft sentimentality, and pretty soon it betrays the very past it remembers.
Is that why it's important, something you write about in the essays, in the journal, historically speaking, in getting underneath the surfaces and writing about what you call the clandestine, some of the things that maybe aren't so pleasant, that maybe we don't want to remember?
Yeah, unless the dog can bring a dirty bone into the house, you're probably not doing your history. All times, and I must say I'm indebted to a French regionalist, a great French regionalist named Guy Twillier, who writes on French small micro regions and places. But the word clandestine, and he got me hooked on that word. But every place, every time has an underside. And the word clandestine is a very nice word because it moves across a spectrum or an arc from absolute illegality over to on the edge. But it's very interesting. The clandestine is almost also a sense. Like today, if I went looking for the clandestine, I might go to the laundromat at 2 in the morning. 50, 60 years ago, and I'm using a cliche, I might have went to the railroad trestle to find where the hobos were. Every town has a house where there's a ghost, a witch, or a red light, so to speak. I mean, there is that underside, but the doubly important thing to recognize about that, our own minds have the clandestine or double side, so it's not like it's always out there, but we light ourselves up more than we're aware of with the other side of things.
Are these difficult, as a local historian, are these difficult things to find and to write about? Are people willing to maybe talk about the clandestine?
Actually, what I found in southwestern Minnesota, and I'm going to, being a frequent visitor over here in South Dakota and Sioux Falls, I think one of the problems is once you start an inquiry, you have a rush of people wanting to tell you about it once the word gets out. Once I'd written, for instance, a book on the Ruthven murders, when the father and son killed two bankers in southwestern Minnesota. 30 years ago this fall. I had people calling me up and wanting to know if I wanted to know the history of the other gun that was in the car when the shooting occurred. I had people call me up, or frequently over a glass of beer, saying, you know, you wrote about this murder. You should be writing about this murder that was never recorded. So I think gossip, fear, suspicion, just talking, and a straightforward honestness, it's amazing how it percolates through an area.
Now, what is the relevance of a story like that, the Ruthven murders, 30 years later, when we go back to the 1980s, the farm crisis? Does that story, these things that happened, does that help us understand what was going on in the 80s, or is this something that's separate from the whole farm crisis issue of the time and the economics and the politics, or is it all woven together?
Well, I'm going to take an alternative to your either or and say it's really, in many ways, a two-bladed axe. It cuts both ways. In this particular case, it cut to a very peculiar father-son relationship. hence the title of my book, When Father and Son Conspire. You can go through the annals of murders and other types of crimes, and usually fathers and sons don't do it together. They stay apart. There's a line not to be crossed between father and son. When it's crossed, you enter I don't mean to sound melodramatic, but you enter a period of great danger when father and sons begin to share intimacies. But on that count, that murder is unique. On the count of being homeless, it belonged. These people were, and they really weren't quite a farm family. In fact, they were carny people in Texas, or they were living in trailers and bumping around in the world after the father got divorced, and they're on, you might say, almost on the economic lamb. And in that story, is far more common than we read in the States. The fact that small farms failed, and theirs did, it was a common story, but it failed because of their particular economics and yet the national economics. At the same time, being when the story occurred, it was immediately incorporated into the struggle between farming and capital. And the whole national farm condition. So in a way, it's all part of the fabric, but I said two ways, in that the event is singular, the people involved are singular, the event is peculiar, but the context was national. A desperate farm region running out of income, not having sufficient money to mortgage, not having sufficient value in its properties that it can mortgage, so it's cash short in an era where you need cash, which is can be a universal story.
The role of local history, particularly as something like this, which you say also had national implications, there's a national part of it, to understand our nation's history, do we have to start at the local history? And so here we're talking about the area of southwest Minnesota, southeastern South Dakota, northwest Iowa.
Carl, it sounds like you should be writing this stuff for me. I mean, it's quite wonderful. Your question couldn't be more perfect for my desire. We must always know the particular to contradict or enhance the general. The mind that only puts things in slots and categories, however high the title, however high the professorial rank, that type of mind, I feel, betrays the richness of the human experience. I forever want the particular to disrupt the theory. No good theory is worth much if it can't also, on its other side, harvest exceptions. Exceptions preserve the soul, expand the imagination, are true to the memory. And the other thing is nice for organization and overall talking and filing, and maybe even produces good books. But I do think we want somebody who always has, at least if they have two eyes, they have yet a third eye open to the eccentric, the peculiar, the underneath, the clandestine, the other, or it ain't necessarily so.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and I'm talking with historian Joseph Amato, who's a professor emeritus at Southwest Minnesota State University in Marshall. We're talking about some of the things he wrote about in a series of essays in the journal Historically Speaking. This is something that gets beyond what we've been talking about, but getting in and reading these essays and learning something new for me when talking about the natural world in this area and how we've adapted that was the importance of the muskrat, which I didn't realize the muskrat was so important. You know, the buffalo is always held in high esteem as the most important animal for, you know, pre-settlement time, but the muskrat was important then and in the years after that.
First off, I do want to say that our region, the Dakotas, Minnesota, northern Iowa, up into North Dakota, we belong to a territory. We belong to grass. We belong to water. And then we belong to the farming or the control or manipulation or the benefits of that grass or water. So we do have universal histories. But we also idealize universal histories. And, of course, the Dakotas would love to universalize their history around the buffalo. I mean, it's high, it's gorgeous, it's Indian culture at its most greatest game, the buffalo hunt with its most feathers. But, in fact, for lots of southwestern Minnesota, that area was marshy, and this would be South Dakota and Minnesota and others. It was marshy. It was not easily crossed. It was filled with mosquitoes. And the normal, and this comes from, by the way, the basic source for my thought is a South Dakota historian, an anthropologist to be more technical, Alan Woolworth, he's had quite a wonderful career writing about this, and he called my attention to the muskrat. The muskrat, when you went into an Indian camp, was often they were skewed, formed in a teepee-like thing around a fire, and that was the first offer of hospitality. You want a muskrat. When the children, when bad times came, even though the Indians were dispersed on the a landscape, they were no longer concentrated in the big familial or even tribal gatherings in the smaller places. The standard fare, at least for meat protein, was the muskrat. Any child or any woman could go out and just break their way into a muskrat nest and have it. That was abundant. And I wanted to say one other thing. If you went to Canada, north of us, their holy animal, aside from the buffalo, too, on the plains. The other one was the beaver. But here we have the short-toothed muskrat being probably the main food source. And it was more in the Midwest than one thinks. I think we deserve a book on the role of the Midwest, the muskrat in the whole upper Midwest.
I'm wondering what this... how this affects our understanding of history when here's something that was quite common that I didn't know about. You know, the muskrat was this important. So, you know, how well are we understanding history in our past if something is as basic as this is essentially more or less lost?
Well, I think that's the excitement when you're an innovative historian. You might be deciding how important was the mushroom in sustaining the people of the Caucasus, Carpathian Mountains. We might be asking, wasn't the chestnut more important for bread and cake in areas of all kinds of Mediterranean areas rather than grain? So that was just to choose some examples from food history. But if we go through different fields, like little technological inventions, like how important was the spring? When did the screw come about and people able to actually bind things together with a screw? How important is the history of glue? I mean, this history is really phenomenal, and it often comes out of the material world. Once we get things, we use them and forget about them. But these things forever make our history. So you're quite right. It's part of the historian's job almost to remind us, oh, you too use an electric razor.
Now, this gets back to the small, and you've written about this quite a bit with surfaces and then dust and... So is this really where you start with in your work as a historian, that start with the small and then go from there?
Well, more and more, my predilection is to grasp the embodied. As you could tell, I think, in the earlier part of the interview and what you yourself said, I love ideas. I love to talk about emotions and spiritualities and all the wonders of the human mind. But more and more, as I get older, I more and more want to stress how embodied we are. That's why I write books with titles like Surfaces, quote, skin, a history, dust, a history of the small, or walking, a book called On Foot, where I'm very concerned with how much does movement, how do we move in time as a body? And I really think better history starts with the body, materiality, and things. And if I could just say one phrase more, I've been reading a lot of very exciting anthropology where people begin to talk about our entanglement. I love that word, even though it's a bit, I like that word, our entanglement with things, and how once we do one thing, then a group of things might dictate we have to do another thing, and that we're in a discourse with our environment. So we're in a discourse with our body, we're in a discourse with things, and we're in discourse with the world around us.